James Parson tells us that in the face of all that Beethoven packs into his Missa Solemnis, the juxtaposition of self-consciously archaic and forward-looking musical idioms, great waves of sound giving way to ethereal stillness, questions of apparent faith probingly set forth, yet enigmatically never entirely resolved, there can be little wonder that some people have found the work more than just a little overwhelming. Nor, too, is it surprising that critical responses have been marked by extremes. Theodor Adorno, noting what he described as the Missus distance silhouettish character, pronounced the work aesthetically fractured, although Adorno arguably exaggerates when he denies the Mass a comprehensible structure. His insistence that it is somehow or other splintered or a kind of unapproachable musical floating island is not so much inaccurate as it is an indication of the work's arresting power to induce a person to stop, listen, and grapple with the concerns and conundrums therein addressed. Beethoven himself, I would argue, composed the piece in such a way as to ensure precisely this. Having begun the Missa Solemnis in 1819, he wrote to the intended dedicatee, his erstwhile student, friend, and patron, Archduke Rudolf, "God sees into my innermost heart and knows that as a man I perform most conscientiously and on all occasions the duties which humanity, God, and nature enjoin upon me." Work on the Mass was not completed until 1823, at which time the composer could look back on a host of pieces founded on a similar fusion of extremes: the Hammerklavier Sonata, the Diabelli Variations, and the Ninth Symphony. Even though each work is radically different, they are nonetheless related to one another by a similarly inspired attempt of colossal import. On the one hand, each work maps out humankind's relationship with the godlike or sublime, and on the other, with nature's realm in the here and now. Each one of these pieces makes near inhuman, transcendent demands on those who perform them. While such demands are not to be minimized in any of the works just mentioned, the fact that Beethoven sees fit to make them in a work requiring full orchestra, vocal soloists, and chorus, and which lasts almost 90 minutes, makes the Missa Solemnis especially daunting. And yet, the very use of such large forces allows Beethoven to invoke humanity at large, the result being that a performance that meets its many Herculean challenges results in not just a diverting or rewarding experience, but one that is positively thrilling. Words of James Parsons in an essay on the Missa Solemnis in the Beethoven Journal. Positively thrilling. That's the kind of experience we're promised in the upcoming performances of the monumental Missa Solemnis with over 200 musicians, featuring the Choral Society of Northeast Pennsylvania, the Marywood University Campus Chorale, soloists, and the Wyoming Seminary Civic Orchestra, under the direction of Rick Hoffenberg. April 28th at Wyoming Seminary in Kingston, and April 29th at Marywood University in Scranton. Dr. Hoffenberg paid a visit to the WVIA studios to talk with us about the music and the rare chance we'll have to hear it.
We actually spent months, truth be told, discussing different pieces, trying to find the right piece for the circumstances, considering all the constraints and everything else, and ultimately decided that the Beethoven Missa Solemnis was, first of all, a piece that both the chorus and orchestra would find challenging, certainly, that goes without saying, but also worthwhile and rewarding. I never want to do a piece with civic orchestra in which the orchestra is relegated to a subordinate role. And a lot of choral works, even great choral works, could be described that way. But when we did the Verdi Requiem, I know the orchestra enjoyed it a lot, and certainly the orchestra gets great things to do in that piece. And the Beethoven is certainly coming from the hand of a symphonic composer, I would say the same thing there. It's tremendously challenging in so many ways, but I had talked to many people with long musical memories who've been in this area, in some cases for generations, and no one knows of a performance of the Beethoven Missa Solemnis in this area. So to me, that's really exciting. There are people here who can tell you about musical works going back for 40 or 50 years in this area. And to be honest, I have great doubts that going back before that time, there would have been an opportunity to perform a piece like this in this area. So I can say with some confidence that this is likely the first performance of the Missa Solemnis in Northeast Pennsylvania, and that's really exciting to me.
What do you have in your own life as a music lover and a music listener? Have you heard a performance of the Missa Solemnis that you just said, wow?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There are people in my chorus who have asked me for a recommendation of a recording, and it's really hard to recommend just one. There are aspects of several performances that I love, and I suppose you could say that about any piece that you're preparing, but I have tried to recommend to them performances that depict the work with clarity and with a certain sort of classical elegance, because there are recordings that get so wrapped up in the drama and the frenzy of some of these fugues that it can just be overwhelming. There's a recording of the piece that's wonderful, don't get me wrong, star soloists, James Levine at the podium, and the Credo Fugue, which is one of the famous spots, at least among choral musicians, for its ferocity. It's so fast that even in the hands of the chorus is the Swedish Radio Choir, first-rate choir by any standard, they're amazing. The tempo and the interpretation is so wild that it just almost sounds chaotic. Now, it's possible Beethoven would have loved that approach. I mean, there's certainly a lot of controversy about the value of his metronome markings. Evidence going back and forth between people saying his metronome may have been broken or they may have been inaccurate, but there's certainly sufficient evidence to suggest that he knew what he was asking for in his symphonies with metronome markings that sometimes seem crazy fast. And we know Beethoven was a very passionate, irascible, unpredictable person. So it certainly fits that he would have written this piece with just terrifying difficulty and such a range of emotions, but that makes it all the more exciting to work on.
What was the precipitating reason that he made this work?
Right, so he'd written two religious choral works previously. In 1803, he wrote Christ on the Mount of Olives, which is not performed very much, and I think the general consensus is that while there are great moments in the piece, and Beethoven may have felt a personal affinity toward the piece, given the fact that Christ on the Mount of Olives was the first piece he completed after the Heiligenstadt Testament, which was when he revealed his deafness and consequent depression over that. But just judging it as a piece of music, it probably isn't Beethoven's most inspired piece. Some parts maybe are a bit formulaic or just not as inventive as Beethoven's best music. He then wrote in 1807, 4 years later, the Mass in C. And I think that's a wonderful work, actually. It also doesn't get performed very much. That was commissioned by Prince Esterházy, who had commissioned every year a Mass in honor of his wife. And the previous six Masses had been composed by Haydn, these wonderful late Haydn Masses that we know. And so after six of them, he turned to Beethoven, and Beethoven produced the Mass in C major in 1807. And even though I think, and many other people think, it's a very laudable work, Prince Esterházy did not like it at all, to put it mildly, called it ridiculous and detestable. And for reasons that are not difficult to understand, Beethoven turned away from religious choral music and towards secular music. So he didn't return to the idea of composing another religious choral work until 1819, so about 12 years after the Mass in C, probably his greatest patron, the Archduke Rudolf, Beethoven found out was going to be essentially being promoted to Archbishop the following March. And so Beethoven wrote to Rudolf in flowery language saying, the privilege of writing a choral work to celebrate your ascendancy will be the most glorious day of my life. And while it's not beyond the realm of possibility to think that Beethoven was being obsequious, certainly composers in general writing to their patrons might behave that way, considering how much the Archduke Rudolf meant to Beethoven, that may actually have been sincere. He had dedicated his last two piano concertos to Rudolf, the great Hammerklavier piano sonata, of course, the Archduke trio. He's the Archduke referred to in that name. So certainly a great patron and very important to Beethoven. So Beethoven accepted that task, and the problem was the ceremony promoting him to, or installing him, I should say, as Archbishop happened in March of 1820, and Beethoven didn't finish the Missa Solemnis until March of 1823, so he was 3 years late. But it's clear that Beethoven agonized somewhat over the piece, really wanted it to come out right, and so he presented it on, as it turns out, the third anniversary of the Archduke's ascendancy to Archbishop.
We know the Verdi Requiem is a show work with drama and that sort of thing, and probably not going to be in a liturgy. Is that the same with this work?
It probably wouldn't be used in a liturgy. At the time it was written, it was, well, first of all, the scale of the piece and the extreme difficulty for both the chorus and orchestra, not to mention the vocal soloists, would make it unlikely for usage there. It's probably too long, and it's written as a concert work. Furthermore, at the time it was written, it couldn't be performed in Vienna in a concert hall. They couldn't perform a sacred mass in that setting, and use in the context of a religious service, you know, for the reasons I just mentioned, were unlikely. So Beethoven never heard a complete performance at all, and it wasn't performed complete in Europe until 3 years after his death. The only performance he heard was actually the premiere of the Beethoven Ninth Symphony. It was the same concert, May of 1824, and it was only three movements that were performed, the Kyrie, the Credo, and the Agnus Dei, I believe. And the performance must have been, frankly, must have been awful. Some of the instrumental parts had not been copied, and apparently the orchestra couldn't read some of Beethoven's notoriously awful handwriting. And the chorus rebelled because this was so much more difficult than anything they had ever seen, and they couldn't sing it. So apparently, our understanding from reports of the time is that the chorus just left out parts that they thought were unreasonably difficult, thinking Beethoven wouldn't know anyway. The guy was stone deaf. So it's hard to believe that the performance was much to hear. Nonetheless, some people still praised the work. It got mixed reviews, but probably didn't have the tremendous reception that the Beethoven Ninth Symphony did at the same performance.
What forces are involved in this performance, and how are you working with the performers to do it?
So it's a fairly standard-sized orchestra, double winds, and the percussion is just timpani. But that being said, there are things in the score that are borderline impossible. And partly it may have been because Beethoven was at the end of his life. By the time it was published after his death, nobody could ask him, did you really mean this? This seems impossible. And so, for example, some of the bassoon and poor contrabassoonist, the contrabassoon lines are just written to double the bass or cello lines that are so crazy difficult on those instruments. And it's hard to know if that's what Beethoven really intended. He may have. He certainly didn't care much about the practicalities of performance. and not just in this piece, but he was notoriously unmoved by various aspects of difficulty surrounding performance. So in a way, there's something to be admired about a composer putting pen to paper and writing simply the piece that's in his head, and any pragmatic difficulties be damned. You know, you all figure out how to make this happen. So in certain spots, it is almost impossible. As a matter of fact, one publication, I believe in the 1880s, so, you know, many decades after Beethoven had died, still called the piece impossible, used that word to describe it. But nonetheless, the orchestral forces are a pretty standard size symphony. You need a good size chorus to do it, and certainly a chorus of great skill. One of the notorious moments, the two great fugues at the end of the Gloria and the Credo are both extremely intricate, chromatic, and fast. And especially in the Credo, you have a long and intricate fugue, and then instead of giving the chorus a break when that's over, he doubles the tempo and gives you an altered version of that fugue at twice the speed. I remember the only performance I've been involved with was Leon Botstein in the American Symphony up at the Bard Festival, and it was great fun. He had an all-professional chorus, and I think he felt that he could do whatever tempos he wanted, but even this all-professional chorus, we were struggling to try to sing it at the tempos he asked of us. But it certainly was fun and very exciting. So the orchestra and the chorus, and then four vocal soloists, soprano, mezzo, tenor, bass, and they have to be really wonderful singers. I'm thrilled to say we have four professional opera singers, four young, up-and-coming opera singers who are all sensational and really well-suited to this piece.
You mentioned the range of emotion and the terrifying power of this piece. What is Beethoven up to in terms of philosophical, spiritual, thematic explorations?
Yeah. Well, first of all, in terms of the spiritual and religious, you always have to ask when a composer writes a religious piece of music, particularly one based on a text as used as often as the Roman Catholic Mass, what is the religiosity of the composer? And, you know, the piece is probably most often compared to the Bach Mass in B minor, although Beethoven probably didn't know that piece. The Bach Mass in B minor wasn't published until after Beethoven had died, 1833. It's not impossible to think that he could have gotten his hands on a score, but certainly unlikely. In the case of Bach, his religious beliefs are unimpeachable. We know very well how important religion was to him. In Beethoven's case, it's much more complicated. Beethoven, on the one hand, insisted that his nephew, who he had custody of, get a religious education, and Beethoven himself took the Last Testament, but at that point in his life, maybe was too frail to refuse. And then on the other hand, there are ways in which he looks more like a believer in pantheism than in Catholicism. He seems to have rejected ritual on many occasions and believed more in the individual's power of religious belief and spiritual belief. And he also embraced some writings of other religions. And he seems to have vacillated in that regard. He also authorized a translation of the Missa Solemnis into German, specifically for use in Protestant areas. So certainly doesn't seem to have been wedded to the idea of this as a Roman Catholic piece. So it's difficult to know how much of this was rooted in religion. I certainly think Beethoven, this piece was very personal to Beethoven. At the top of the copy that he gave to the Archduke or Archbishop Rudolf, he wrote "from the heart." And then he wrote the second part of that phrase, I think is something along the lines of, and may it remain from the heart, something along those lines. So clearly it meant a lot to him. And aside from his opera Fidelio, it's his most ambitious piece, his longest, and took him the longest to complete. As far as the form, he really embraced a wide variety of influences. I mean, you hear certainly the influence of Palestrina all throughout the choral writing, the use of equal voiced imitation. And at the same time, you can see that he had been studying the Handel Messiah. As a matter of fact, there's a quote in the Agnus Dei from the Messiah. The first four notes of the Dona Nobis Pacem motive are from the Messiah. He had studied the Mozart Requiem and even wrote out part of the Requiem by hand himself in order to, I guess, more fully embrace it and get it into his head. So he had been looking back to works of the classical era and earlier, and somehow filtered that through his own symphonic lens. And the result is really, it's unique. There's nothing else like it in the repertoire. And the form ranges from something straightforward like the Kyrie, which is ABA, very clear. The return of the A section is with very little variation, and the B section is clearly different in the middle, in mood, and in motives, and so forth. But then you have other longer movements like the Gloria and Credo, which seem almost through compose, almost like a narrative, and it's really difficult to follow what his idea of form may have been. At the time, late in his career, he was fascinated by theme and variations, but that seems not to have played into this piece at all, which is also interesting. There are many wonderful touches that have to do with the formal structure. One is the introduction of the Benedictus. Some composers will combine the Sanctus and Benedictus movements into one. In some cases, they're totally separate. What Beethoven does is he connects them with the introduction of a solo violin starting very high in its range and gradually coming down. And it almost seems like this is a representation of the Holy Spirit coming down to earth. It's just a wonderful moment. And the piece almost becomes a violin concerto for a time, because the solo violin plays such an important role in the Benedictus. And then in the Agnus Dei, you see the influence of Haydn in many respects, but one obvious one in that in the midst of rather pastoral music, he suddenly interrupts himself, and you have this kind of martial motif where the strings are doing tremolando and the soloists come in with this recitative motive, and it really seems out of the blue. And many scholars have pointed out that the first of Haydn's Esterházy masses, the Mass in Time of War, had just such an interruption in the Agnus Dei. So Beethoven almost certainly knew that piece and may have been influenced by it. But also you see things like that in the last movement of the Beethoven Ninth Symphony, where, you know, there are surprising interruptions. I mean, where does this Turkish march come from in the middle of the last movement? So it's hard to know exactly what influences played into the piece, but it is thoroughly individualistic. There is no other work to compare it to, and it certainly hasn't ever gained and probably never will gain the popularity of some of the other great choral works by other composers, nor of the Beethoven Ninth Symphony. But I think a lot of that is just due to the difficulty. These passages that were often called impossible, even to this day, are just so difficult for the chorus at the tempos that Beethoven seems to have wanted. And if, as I seem to be led to believe, if this is the first performance of the Beethoven Missa Solemnis in Northeast Pennsylvania, I have to believe that's a big reason why, is the imposing and intimidating difficulties, certainly not because the piece isn't worthy of performance.
Where do we hear it, Rick?
We're going to do two performances. The first will be on Saturday, April 28th at 7:30 p.m. at the Kirby Center for Creative Arts on the Wyoming Seminary campus in Kingston. And then the next day, Sunday, April 29th at 2 o'clock, will be in the Setla Vergata Auditorium at Marywood University. And I want to be sure to mention and thank the choral artists of Northeast Pennsylvania who are joining the concert choir at Marywood. Dr. Alan Baker graciously and altruistically has given up so much of his time and his chorus's time in order to prepare this piece. And so we're excited to join forces with them, as we did for the Verdi Requiem, and with the Civic Orchestra of Wyoming Seminary.
People rise to the occasion, don't they, when given marvelous material like this, even if it's hard, they want to do it.
I think that's absolutely true. And I really am optimistic. As we struggle and battle with this piece, I think it's pushing us all. And I think ultimately the results will be rewarding, certainly for the performing forces, and I hope for the audience as well.
Dr. Rick Hoffenberg, co-chair of the Department of Music, Theater, and Dance at Marywood University, and music director and conductor of the Wyoming Seminary Civic Orchestra, speaking with us about Beethoven's Missa Solemnis, to be presented Saturday, April 28th, at Wyoming Seminary in the Kirby Center for Creative Arts, and that's in Kingston, just across the river from Wilkes-Barre, at 7:30 p.m. And again, Sunday, April 29th, at 2 in the afternoon, in the Seth LaVerghetta Center at Marywood University in Scranton. For more information, on the web, wyomingseminary.org, wyomingseminary.org. That's the Wyoming Seminary Civic Orchestra and the Choral Society of Northeast Pennsylvania, the Marywood University Chorale and Soloists, performing the Missa Solemnis by Beethoven, Saturday, April 28th, at the Kirby Center for Creative Arts on the campus of Wyoming Seminary in Kingston, just across the river from Wilkes-Barre, that's Saturday evening at 7:30, and again, Sunday, April 29th at 2 in the Seth LaVerghetta Center for the Performing Arts at Marywood University in Scranton. Admission to these performances is free. It's a free performance of the Beethoven Missa Solemnis, and for more information on the web, wyomingseminary.org, wyomingseminary.org.